All right, again, we are in Acts 23, but as we always do, we just give a few major points with regard to the previous chapter, and that was the 22nd chapter that we discussed in our study last week. A very important chapter with regard to teaching what one must do to be saved. We often make reference to Acts the 22nd chapter in verse 16, where the apostle Paul was told by Ananias, "Why are you tearing? Arise, be baptized, wash away your sins," indicating that the culmination of Paul's conversion from his days of insolence and fighting against the Lord to becoming a child of God, and then of course the apostleship that he was given by the Lord himself, that conversion culminated in Damascus, not on the road to Damascus, but in Damascus. Because when you look at verse 16, you find that the sins were not washed away. They had not been taken away until the point in which he was baptized. And that's what is indicated very clearly by that text. So keep that in mind as a serious application we can make. You always look for those doctrinal things that you can emphasize and ways of approaching discussions that you might have with others who disagree with you. And that's one of the verses that are very helpful to us. But Paul here had addressed a mob of Jews, and it had happened from the steps of the Roman barracks there in Jerusalem. And he was defending his actions against false accusations that he had taken a Gentile into the temple and desecrated the temple and taught things that were troubling, had denied the old law, some of these accusations, in fact, all of them were actually false, as we discussed in our lesson last week. But when he began to talk about Christ as the anointed of God, as the one that God had chosen, the Jews persisted in their desire to execute him, which led to the Roman commander examining him, but taking him away from the mob. And examining him, he had to have Paul scourged, as indicated in verses 22 through 24 of the text. But this is where Paul revealed himself to be a Roman citizen. So it halted everything until the next day. And this is where we pick up in chapter 3, following that mob and following, as verse 30 indicated, the commander had wanted to know for certain why he was accused by the Jews. So he released him from his bonds, commanded the chief priests and all their council to appear, and brought them down and set Paul before him. So now the defense that the Apostle Paul is giving, beginning in chapter 23, is with regard to the Sanhedrin. So if you will, begin reading with me. Let's look at, let's start off with the first five verses of the text, if you will, and read along chapter 23, verses 1 through 5. Paul looked earnestly at the council and said, "Men and brethren, I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day. And the high priest Ananias commanded those who stood by him to strike him on the mouth. And Paul said to him, 'God will strike you, you whitewashed wall. For you sit to judge me according to the law, and do you command me to be struck contrary to the law?' And those who stood by said, 'Do you revile God's high priest?' And Paul said, 'I did not know, brethren, that he was the high priest, for it is written, you shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people.'" And so there are a couple of points to be made in regard to this text that I want to note. First of all, is his reference to these individuals, these Jews in this Sanhedrin, as brethren. And it just harkens back to a point we made in the 22nd chapter that some have used to indicate that Jesus was already a Christian before he ever got into Damascus, because Ananias referred to him as a brother. And the reason for that is because they were both Jews. And it's the exact same reason that the Apostle Paul on this occasion refers to these individuals as his brethren. They were his countrymen. They were his Jewish brethren. It is that cultural aspect of it, his nationality, that he's referring to here, as Ananias did. And it was not surprising that he would utilize this particular greeting because of his desire, not to anger them for anger's sake. I think the Apostle Paul knew that in his defense that they were going to become angry at him anyway. And his purpose was not simply to get them upset at him, not to provoke them in any way, simply to preach the truth. And And as always, it is the case, and this is something we need to keep in mind as well, when we preach the truth, we need to, as Paul did, become all things to all men, that we might by some means save some. Our motivation should always be to save souls, not to win arguments. Now, in order to save souls, sometimes you have to win arguments. And that's what the Apostle Paul was doing right here in giving his defense and explaining Christ to them. But that wasn't his intent. Now, let me just give a contrast. A lot of times on social media these days, I've seen it a lot with Christians, they'll send out a provocative post just to get people to disagree with them so they can win an argument. And names will be called, and dismissiveness is present. There is vitriol that is seen, anger, those kinds of things in these posts. And it's easy to troll online, but there's a person responds in kind, and there's not really the kind of approach to things that you see that should be present among Christians. And that doesn't mean compromise. It never means compromise. And Paul in no way compromised here, but his greeting there, as he looked earnestly at the council, this was important to him. This was a serious thing. It was his desire to convert them, to convince them of the truth. He said, "I have lived in all good conscience." And then, and he said, "Men and brethren, I have lived in all good conscience until this day." Now the question is given up on the board that we can go to in the next point before we look at a couple other things and go on. So the question that was asked on the handout that we have is, since Paul had lived in all good conscience before God until this day, how can that be when he persecuted Christians? So what's the simple answer to that question? He didn't. He sinned, didn't he? He was. Okay, so. Okay, so that's a good point to make, and so that indicates then that the conscience can be wrong, can it? Okay, so let's enlarge that just a little bit more. Did Paul make a mistake by living in all good conscience until that day? Okay, so give me the no, because the no is important.
If we violate our conscience, then it's sin.
Okay. Okay, good. So, but that's a separate issue from the conscience itself in regard to the instruction of it. So, I've used the phrase "gigo," which is G-I-G-O, which is I may be out of date now, but it was a computer nomenclature, garbage in, garbage out, is what it stands for, and that's what I want you to think about. This is the easiest way I have of explaining the conscience. It's a moral computer, and so if you feed into the moral computer everything accurately, then it's going to give you an accurate response. But if the computer is told 2 plus 2 equals 5 instead of 2 plus 2 equals 4 when you type in this stuff, you're going to get garbage because it won't be right. So Paul was in effect on the horns of a dilemma in regard to this. And this is true with each and every one of us. If our conscience is wrong. He was an individual who thought it was necessary to persecute those who are of the way. He thought that he was serving God in so doing. He was a zealous Pharisee. He lived in all good conscience until that day, but he was wrong. And that was the correction that took place, as we read in Acts 22, by his own testimony, and also in Acts 9 with regard to the conversion itself. So with regard to this, his conscience was clean, but he hadn't fed it the right things. So if he would have violated his conscience as a Jew, a zealous Pharisee, and he said, I know that this is something I'm supposed to do, but I'm not going to do it. That's rebellion against God. So he would be sinning if he, I'm not saying he would be sinning if he didn't, it didn't, or that it would be a sin not to persecute Christians. I'm just saying him personally, it would be a sin to rebel against God because he wasn't doing what his conscience dictated he should do. And that's the whole point, is you always follow your conscience. But it's required of us that our conscience be educated correctly. Because otherwise, again, a computer is a dumb machine. It's amazing, but it's because someone programmed it and put the good things in, which makes it able to do what it can do. And that's the way the moral computer is. So now the Apostle Paul, his conscience was right. He understood that Jesus was the Christ. Who are you, Lord? I'm Jesus whom you're persecuting. What do you want me to do, Lord? He lived in all good conscience till that day, and he did what he was told to do. And so he didn't violate his conscience ever. But he did sin when his conscience was incorrect. His conscience wasn't his conscience incorrect. The instructions given to his conscience was incorrect. And so he did things that were wrong that he thought were right. But we are told that we're always to follow the dictates of our conscience. And if we don't, we're rebelling. Can you imagine someone saying, okay, I know that I should partake of the Lord's Supper on the first day of the week, but I'm not going to do it. I know I should, but I'm not. Well, that's sinful for a number of reasons, because you're not filling the command, but also because you're rebelling against God with your conscience. To use it in matters of inconsequential things, we have in Romans chapter 14, we have the eating of meats and the observance of days, both things that God accepts, the man who does those kinds of things. But let's say a man, he thinks it's a bad thing to eat meat, and it violates his conscience. But he sees someone else doing it, so he eats the meat. He thinks it's wrong, but he does it anyway. Well, what he does, the reason he thinks it's wrong, because he thinks God told him it was wrong, that God does not allow it. And so now if I do it when I'm thinking God doesn't allow it, it doesn't matter whether God allows it or not. I think that God doesn't allow it, so I'm telling God, I'm not going to do what you tell me to do. And that's a sin of rebellion. And so we need to follow that conscience. And the Apostle Paul, of course, did in every aspect of his life. He was an insolent man at certain times. He was certainly a sinner. He was a zealous Pharisee that rejected the Lord initially. And as a result of that, he was guilty of sin. Okay. Now, the second thing is the conflict between Ananias, the high priest, and Paul. And this is another example. Paul saw someone in the Sanhedrin who said, strike him. Paul knew that it was not something that was acceptable. He had not been convicted. He had only been confused. He hadn't been given his opportunity to give a defense of himself directly to them. And he said, it's against this law for you to strike me at this point in time, but you're doing it. And he called him whitewashed wall, which was the reviling of what happened to be the high priest. But apparently Paul didn't recognize Ananias as the high priest. He didn't know that he was, because he immediately apologized for what he had done, because he found out that what he had said was something that was inappropriate because of Ananias being the high priest. And this is just a demonstration of his good conscience. You know, what he did first, he didn't think there was anything wrong with it, but he found out there was something wrong with it, so he apologized for having done it. And that is an indication of the truthfulness of what he said when he said, I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day. Okay, so any comments, questions before we go on to the next section? Okay, in verse 6 then, and going down through verse 10, Paul perceived that one part of the Sanhedrin were Sadducees. Sadducees are typically the higher echelon Jews. They were they had a lot of influence, had a lot of authority, but they did not believe in the resurrection. The Pharisees, the more zealous religiously, they did. So he saw that one part were Sadducees, one part Pharisees. He cried out in the council, men and brethren, I'm a Pharisee. That right there causes a division, I think. That's all that it would take to cause that division. Okay, you Pharisees, I'm one of you guys. And, okay, Sadducees wouldn't like that too much. But Pharisees, okay, well, let's listen to what he has to say. And this is what he had to say. He said in verse 6 and following, he said, concerning the hope and resurrection of the dead, I am being judged. If you want to look at that hope, you can go to 1 Corinthians 15 and talk about the hope that we have as Christians. If in this life only we have hope, we're of all men to be most pitied. But he had hope and the resurrection, which of course is the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And he's being judged because of that. When he had said this, a dissension arose between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. The assembly was divided, for the Sadducees say, there is no resurrection and no angel or spirit. But the Pharisees confessed both. And when there arose a loud outcry, the scribes of the Pharisee party arose and protested, saying, we find no evil in this man. Okay, so he got the Pharisees on his side, didn't he? But if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him, let us not fight against God. So, okay, maybe now God's on his side, and what he's saying is actually from God. So there arose a great dissension. The commander, fearing lest Paul might be pulled to pieces by them, commanded the soldiers to go down and take him by force from among them and bring him into the barracks. So now a tumult arises again. And understand this. This is an amazing thing about Paul's defenses. He never said things that would get him into less trouble. He never compromised. He never tried to phrase it in such a diplomatic way that maybe he wouldn't suffer as a result of it. He always told the truth. Now, this truth was something on this occasion that was helpful to him. I won't deny that. And I asked the question there up on the board, why might Paul take advantage of the doctrinal difference regarding the resurrection that stood between the Pharisees and the Sadducees? Why did he do that? Why did he bring up the resurrection and call himself a Pharisee?
When I read this, it makes me think of politics. He's been a little politician here in a way. Often we see that when we are, we see society or one side of the spectrum that is critical of their person, and how quickly, what do? They say, well, look at the guy on the other side, look how bad they are, and they try to find that. And then the Pharisees, how quick they were to turn. You know, all you had to do is identify with them, and on this one issue, find that agreement, and then they turned on the Sadducees like that, and supported Paul. But they still, they're being very hypocritical here.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's, well, maybe God is with him. Well, if God's with him, why you weren't listening to him about Christ? Because they haven't admitted that he was right about Christ yet. It's just in this moment, they're so bad at the other side, they're compromising their beliefs again.
Yeah. My enemy's enemy is my friend type thing. I agree with you on all of that, except I think it's a very ugly accusation to say that Paul was political. Now, one thing to note with regard to this is that that by making this distinction, he did put them at odds with one another. That also took it out of the hands of the Jews. And now, I'm not sure if I put that actually up on the board or not, Pharisees began to support him, but it caused the tumult. And as a result of that, the appeal to Caesar, of course, came next, but it basically gets it out of the Jews' hands and into the Romans' hands, which is something that was certainly beneficial, because I think the Apostle Paul knew that if he, just like with his Lord, that if his final the final determinations were dependent upon what the Jews had to say, he was in trouble. And you have more dispassionate reaction by the Romans to these kinds of things, certainly by the commander on this occasion, and ultimately to Caesar, though it was a bit of a chance to take his appeal to Caesar, but he eventually was let go. And in here, I mean, Paul was willing to go bound and to die in Jerusalem. That didn't mean he wanted to die. In fact, in the Epistle to the Philippians, as he was in prison in Rome, he said, it'd be great for me to die, I'd be with the Lord, but it's better for me to stay and to help you. And that's the better thing. And so Paul wasn't wanting to. It's kind of an interesting, I wouldn't say a contradiction, but it is an interesting aspect of his faith, is that Paul did not want to be in trouble. Paul did not want to get beaten. Paul did not want to have his life in danger. But Paul was not willing to compromise anything to get there with regard to the gospel of Christ. And that's something that's evident in even these words. So that's the point that I wanted to make about that. And the second thing we just will note is the difference between the Sadducees and the Pharisees. The Sadducees, you remember, actually brought up a hypothetical to Jesus about a man who had a wife and he had brothers and they all died and never gave her never gave the son who died first, or the man who died first, an heir. And then finally the woman died. Whose wife will she be in the resurrection? And so the Sadducees, they thought that they had an argument that would show that there is no such thing as a resurrection, but they were wrong. And Jesus very clearly indicated God saying, I am the God of Abraham. God's not the God of the living, dead, but of the living, which is an indication that the soul remained and that Abraham was still alive. He was in paradise, in fact. So we see that truth that is established here in this place. Yes?
I think there's something when Paul picked something to kind of turn the odds, you know, to kind of work out, because like you said, he wasn't going to interfere here or there. He didn't pick something that was just helping him, you know, that would just turn out well, that this did. He picked something that really they needed to be arguing about. They needed to figure out, because if they continued after he left, if they continued working this out, you know, what's right concerning the resurrection of death, I mean, ultimately that points to Christ.
Yes, exactly.
You know, and so even, I don't know if this was all going through his head as he was thinking through all this, but he picked something that would divide them, that would turn out for him, that would also be something that if they continued down that path, would lead them.
We might also note, as an aside to this kind of thing, that these individuals were all the most influential in Judaism. They were the Sanhedrin. They were the individuals who were ruling the Jewish class, and they were willing to set aside theological differences, pretty significant theological differences on most occasions, to unify together in various causes. And this, of course, is not an example of that, but I've always thought that is a peculiar thing. You've got someone who says there is a resurrection, someone who says they're not, and yet they're going to get along in most cases. And it's because it had become such a nationalistic and cultural thing for them. It was less, I mean, with more with the Pharisees and with the Sadducees, but certainly the Sadducees, it was less about the religious aspects of the law and the fact that it was the national law and they were the leaders of the people. And it would seem to us, perhaps, that if such a significant issue was in discussion and at large, that they wouldn't be able to get together at all, but they often did, and they often did against Jesus, as we see in his ministry and life. Okay, so that's one thing to keep in mind as well with those first 10 verses. And appreciate very much the kind comments that are made with regard to it. Now we get to verses 11 through 22, which is we don't have to spend much time on this particular point, but even though he was taken so that they would not pull him to pieces, he commanded the soldiers and take him by force from among them. And again, this shows the dispassionate nature of the Romans. This is a Roman citizen now, we know this. And these people are about to tear him apart. We're not going to let that happen. So they put soldiers in there to the Sanhedrin saying, we'll use force against you unless you give us this man. And so for the Romans, it especially noted, I don't care if you're a Pharisee or a Sadducee, I don't care if you're a Christian or not, but if you're a Roman citizen, there are laws. And you're not going to violate those laws. You're not allowed to. And so since they didn't get Paul in that way, we're told the following night that the Lord stood by him and said, be of good cheer, Paul, as you have testified for me in Jerusalem, so now you must all bear witness in Rome. And so this is, again, an indication that his appeal to Caesar, his appeal as a Roman, or his statement to Rome as a Roman citizen, he was a Roman citizen, his later appeal to Caesar is going to get him to Rome, which is now, the Holy Spirit told him, this is what we do next. And that's the way it was accomplished. So when it was day, some of the Jews banded together, bound themselves under an oath, saying that they would neither eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. There were more than 40 who had formed this conspiracy, and they came to the chief priests and elders and said, we have bound ourselves under a great oath that we'll eat nothing until we have killed Paul. So you, together with the council, suggest to the commander that he be brought down to you tomorrow, as though you were going to make further inquiries concerning him, but we're ready to kill him before he comes near. So when Paul's sister's son heard of the ambush, he went in and entered the barracks, and he told Paul. And Paul called one of the centurions to him and said, take this young man to the commander, for he has something to tell him. Interesting that he said that instead of going and making that appeal or having that appeal made himself. I think I might would say the same thing if I was in, you know, it was true. And he this is the best way of approaching it. The commander took him by the hand, went aside, asked him privately, what is it you have to tell me? Well, the Jews have agreed to ask that you bring Paul down to the council as though they were going to inquire. But do not yield to them, verse 21, for more than 40 of them lie in wait for him, men who have bound themselves by an oath that they will neither eat nor drink till they have killed him. And now they're ready, waiting for the promise from you. So the commander let the young man depart and commanded him, tell no one that you have revealed these things to me. Now, as we continue on, as a result of that, that Paul avoided being killed, and we'll see in verses 23 through the end of the chapter exactly what happened. But very simple question. How many men lay in wait? How many were?
40.
It's 40. And what did they promise? What was the oath? Man, they must be hungry and thirsty by now. They were ineffectual in the oath that they gave. But there are some lessons I think can be learned from this, just as an aside. But basically is this. Again, with God's providence and these things took place, is that Paul was protected. Paul did not suffer that death. It is an interesting thing that they, when they crucified Jesus, the council indicated we cannot put someone to death. This is a mob. This wasn't anything lawful about this, and they knew it. They just were angry enough at Paul that they are willing to kill him, and probably, or there's a good chance, well, maybe not, since he's a Roman citizen, but there was a chance maybe they'd get away with it if they did, very possibly could. But they were taking a risk by making this oath. But there is something to be said about making oaths that you can't keep. And that's something we must keep in mind as well. Not that we as Christians are to be in a habit of making oaths, because it should not be necessary. Our yes should be yes and our no should be no, and we should not need any more than that. Our word is our bond. As Christians, this is required of us. Can you imagine this idea? And this is the reason why there are Bibles in courts, and there are there is the promise, a swearing in of witnesses, and if they do something that is not true in their statements, then it's perjury, because there is a distinction that's made in our law, and understandably so, that lying is bad, but lying under oath is criminal. And because it's such an important thing, whatever the testimony might be and whatever the situation is, we're going to make you swear on a holy Bible that you're going to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth. So help you God. And that's what the swearing is. That's basically what this is here. We have promised we're not going to eat, we're not going to drink until we kill Paul. And then they weren't given the opportunity, so they couldn't keep their promise. But it was a very serious promise that was made. So one of the things to keep in mind, I think, from this is the fact that we're not to give oaths and we're not to be that way. But the second thing is found from James, where the Apostle Paul talked about the lives that we live, even vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. And someone says, I'm going to go to such and such a city and buy and sell a year there and make a profit. He said, "What? That's arrogance. What you should say is, if the Lord wills, I'll do this." And if they would have done that, said, listen, if we're able to, this is what we want to do. We'd like to kill him. We want to try our best to kill him. I'm not saying it's a good thing, But they made an oath that we are going to kill him, when in fact that wasn't within their power. And we can do the same thing in less injurious things and less severe things by simply saying, I'm going to do this, do that, do the other, fully intending to do it, but not having the opportunity. And at the very least, we always need to keep in our mind that it's arrogance for us to think we have control over our lives, control over circumstances, because we don't always. And that phrase or that thought, if the Lord wills, goes a long way in this regard. And if I can, if the Lord wills, if it's possible, I will do this. And you make those promises, that's good. And your intention is good. But if you say, I'm going to do it no matter what, you're being pretty arrogant to think that you can do such a thing if it's not God's will. So it's just something to kind of throw into my mind to keep in mind. Okay, so this gets us then, we answer the question, there are more than 40 men vowing neither to eat or drink till they kill Paul. So it gets us to the final couple of questions in the chapter, the final section of our study, which is in verses 23 through 35 of the text. Again, I apologize for going so quickly, but that's the way a survey goes. In verse 23, he called for two centurions. Now this was in response to the oath that was overheard and the commander finding this out. So these centurions, we're talking about centurions over 100 men. And this is the commander. Prepare 200 soldiers and 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen. Now, the Apostle Paul, as a Roman citizen threatened in this way, that he was an important individual because of his citizenship. So prevent and have them go to Caesarea at night. Provide mounts to set Paul on and bring him safely to Felix the governor. 200, and that's just some soldiers. Then 470 men, soldiers, those on horse and those with spears to protect Paul. Can you imagine 470 men? You're right there in the middle of them, and they're surrounding you as they're going on, and they're going to Caesarea. So there are a couple of things to note with regard to Caesarea. They were taken there, and then after he called them to do that, he wrote a letter to Claudius Lysias, and the most excellent. This is Claudius Lysias. He is the commander to the most excellent governor Felix. Now notice the protection of self in this phrase. This man was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them. Coming with the troops, I rescued him, having learned he was a Roman. Okay. Was that actually true? No, it really wasn't. In fact, he was going to have him scourged to find out what was going on, if you'll remember. Then he found out that he was Roman. So it wasn't just rescue, it was to stop the mob, wasn't it? There was unrest in the city of Jerusalem, and he wanted to deal with it. But when I wanted to know the reason they accused him, I brought him before their council, found out he was accused concerning questions of their law, but had nothing charged against him deserving of death or chains. And when it was told me the Jews lay in wait, I sent him immediately to you, commanded his accusers to state before you the charges against him. So here is the thing. It's out of my hands. I'm taking you. Now you're going to the governor, to Felix, and I've got him there safely, and I've told them, you got a problem with him, you go to the governor, the Roman governor, you talk to the governor about it, and I'm out of it. And that's exactly what he was trying to do. He just didn't want that obligation anymore. And so that's how he ended up, first with Felix, then with Festus Agrippa, and the appeal was made that ended up with a trip to Rome, where he spent time under house arrest, and in prison because of his appeal to Caesar about these things. And then Caesar eventually let him go, as we know. So that's the letter, and I thought that was an interesting thing. But then in verses 31 through 35, there are a couple of other points to be made. The soldiers, as they were commanded, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. Next day they left the horsemen to go on with him, returned to the barracks. When they came to Caesarea and had delivered the letter to the governor, they presented Paul to him. And when the governor had read it, he asked what province he was from. When he understood he was from Cilicia, he said, I will hear you when your accusers have come. And he commanded him to be kept in Herod's praetorium. So, a couple of questions about this. One, we've already discussed. Who was the governor that Paul was sent to? It was Felix, wasn't it? Okay? So the second thing, what is a praetorium? Anybody know? Oh, so you've got a center reference Bible that you appeal to. So you just didn't know it. You just looked and, okay, that's all right. That's all right. It's good to use that. Yeah, it is. The praetorium is basically where he lived. Do remember that Caesarea, and there it was called Caesarea Maritime, I think is the reference. There are a lot of cities that are named Caesarea because everywhere the Caesar had power, the people wanted to pay homage to him, and so cities were built or named after him. So Caesarea is in a lot of different places. But this Caesarea is on the coast of the Mediterranean Sea. I've actually had an opportunity to visit there on one occasion. An interesting point about this particular city was in Caesarea, the actual physical evidence, archaeological evidence of Pilate's existence as a prelate or a governor was found. One of the objections that individuals had concerning the Bible in the past is that there is no indication in literature or anywhere that there was such a man by the name of Pilate. And so this is what often is done by modernists and other critics of the Bible. What they'll basically say is, we don't have evidence of it, so it didn't happen. And so, you know, in effect, we haven't found anything to corroborate it. So we can't know that it was true? Okay. I mean, the Bible has been proven so many times over, even that's a little bit disingenuous. But for someone to say we haven't found the evidence to corroborate what the Bible says, so it's not so, is something that is typical of many scholars. And in this particular case, there was a large stone that was found, excavated, that had Pilate's name and it stated that he was Pontius Pilate, that he was the prelate or the governor of Judea at a particular time. So the man existed, of course, as we know from the narrative of Scripture, but it's something that we have corroboration from these things. There's a real pretty amphitheater there and a lot of ruins. But the praetorium was basically the governor's house, and it served several purposes. There were, again, more than one praetorium, but it's the one here in Caesarea. So it's where the prison is found as well. So you think about that, like the courthouse downtown, Texas Ranger Courthouse downtown. That courthouse has maybe jails or holding cells or whatever, as well as the judgment halls and all that kind of stuff. But it also, if it were back in at that time, would be where the leader in that area, that's where he stayed. So it was kind of a palace as well. So that's just all of the praetorium, and I wanted to note that. We're told that it's called Herod's praetorium because it was built by Herod. And that's a, hey, I've got a center reference too. And mine says it was a headquarters, just like yours. So. All right. Anybody have any comments or any questions? Yes,
David.
If we were in Paul's sandals, so to speak, it might feel like things were really spinning out of control. Falsely accused, they try to kill me, the Romans going to beat me, and I was able to stop them. But blessed with Scripture, we're able to see that it sure looks like the Lord's plan is unfolding.
Yeah.
And everything's in control.
Yeah. And when he told him, the Spirit told him he was going to, okay, you've done it in Jerusalem, now you're going to do it to Caesar. Logical step. And so having that confidence and surety that he was doing what was expected of him and it was happening as expected. And that's one of the reasons why you remember they were shipwrecked on the way to Rome, and that didn't bother Paul either. No one's going to lose their lives. Everything's going to work out fine. And, of course, he was told that as well. But it wasn't something that he was concerned about as far as losing his life, because he had been told what he was going to have to do. In Philippians 1, he's at the point there to where he said, I think I still have more things to do. He didn't have quite the surety, but he was pretty confident even then that he would remain alive because of the needs that others had. But up to that point in time, he was, I think, pretty confident that he was going to make it all the way to Rome, as the Spirit had told him. Yes, Chris?
Talking to his nephew, that shows that, you know, that trust that Paul had in God is also in a providential
prepare even through the Romans, even through the military, because the Holy Spirit had told them, you're going to make the throne. When his nephew came and said, hey, the Jews are going to kill you, he didn't tell his nephew, no, it's okay, God's going to take care of it. He said, tell them, and they'll take care of it. You know, if would Paul have made it to Rome if he wasn't surrounded by 470 troops? Yeah. But Paul chose, it didn't diminish his faith in God to allow the rulers that God works.
Well, that's what we need to know about the way providence works. And I've said this many times, that God helps those who help themselves. I've used an illustration once. I think I used it on a Thursday study I had with that class I'm teaching. But there a woman who had, she didn't study for the test, but she prayed hard for God to let her pass, and she failed. And she failed because she didn't do her part. You know, God could have done his part, but she wanted God to do her part too. And so that's something. And we find many, many examples. The thing about God's providence, it's working behind the scene. Now, we've got the narration that is given to us so that we sometimes can see God's providence, but his providence still works in our lives. But what we do is we live righteously, we pray for certain things, we study, and then we make the decision, and if there is something that God has for us or wants for us, then it'll all work out. And whatever the decision is with his help. How can I prove it? I can't prove it. That's the way providence works. It's an anecdotal thing. And I've told you many times that I feel like us coming to Fort Worth was a matter of God's providence. Now, can I prove that? No, I can't prove it. But I had another opportunity at the time that I could have had, but I chose this one. And it's, for me, it's, and my family, it's been a great 30 plus years. So maybe God had a hand in it. I can't prove that to you. You may have wished I hadn't come, but the fact is that God does work in the background, and that's something we have faith and confidence in. All right. Appreciate very much God's attention. We are very much everyone's kind of attention. We're going to stop here. We'll pick up with Acts chapter 24 in our next study. And I appreciate the fact that you're here. Thank you.